This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, so Harley asked me to introduce Olivier, and since I have been trying to get Olivier to come to Goddard for a long time and give this talk to the Atlas team, I just want to do a short intro. Olivier was part of the HDST Aura Committee, and I think really was one of the very influential members in terms of really explaining the ability of segmented coronography relative to HDST and Atlas, and has a lot of history doing this with ground telescopes. I don't know your full CV. I know you're a professor at University of Arizona. You're a principal investigator and a few other major accolades. But I think really the impressive thing is his understanding of not just the designs of these things, but actually having worked and turning wrenches and writing software to build and test these things. So I think this is the best opportunity we will have to really get into to talk to somebody who's a true expert in this field. And I'll let
Olivier. Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. This is a lot of fun to come here, and especially I enjoyed looking at a real telescope, a real big
space telescope.
So I'm going to talk about coronography for large segmented aperture, and a lot of what I'm going to speak about is not specifically limited to segmented aperture, but one of the message of this, one of the points that we are addressing in this presentation is are there specific issues, or are there showstoppers to doing high contrast imaging on segmented apertures? So this is the...
Does that include also obscured apertures?
Yes. So what I really mean by segmented is something that either has a hole in the middle, spiders, or segments. And so I don't make a... As far as the coronagraph design is concerned, there's no specific difference between those different cases. I'll just go straight to the first topic. So the scientific motivation is that there are a lot of large telescopes coming up in near future and very near future and a little more distant future that are segmented, and all of the very large telescope concepts are segmented. So and of course one of the very scientifically interesting things we want to do with those large telescopes, look at exoplanets, which is a high contrast imaging problem. So one of the key problems that some of us are working on is can we use these telescopes for high contrast imaging, and if we can, how well will they work compared to unobstructed apertures? So here I have pictures of the W1st-AFSA telescope, 2.4 meter. As I was just describing, I'm putting it in the list of segmented aperture because as far as the coronagraph light diffraction is concerned, it has four segments, which are separated by the spiders. Actually, it's more than four. This is a concept for the ATLAS or HDST large segmented aperture, and there are also large ground-based telescopes such as the GMT and the TMT that are being developed right now, and they will be segmented. And those two illustrate two very different aperture geometries. The GMT has a few very large segments, and the TMT has a lot of small segments. So why do we want to use those large telescopes for exoplanet imaging? Because the image gets the data quality is a steep function of aperture size, not just because we're looking at faint planets, which is what most astronomers are familiar with what big telescopes bring is better flux sensitivity, but also because we have to fight against a very small linear separation between a planet and a star. So we gain by increasing the telescope size, by gaining this angular resolution to separate the planet from the star, and to make also the image of the planet sharper. A few numbers in terms of efficiency. So we gain several things from using a larger. The first one is efficiency and yield. And a few numbers here. If we look at the number of stars that are accessible based on inner working angle, it scales as the third power of the telescope diameter. So essentially, you increase the telescope by a factor of two. You can go twice as far, which means your volume increased by 2^3. For a given target, the exposure time required to reach a given Bayesian signal to noise ratio goes as d to the minus 4, because habitable planet imaging is a background binary, a background limited detection problem. The characterization is much better if you have a larger telescope. You can get to a longer wavelength, which is usually important, because a lot of the interesting signatures in the spectra, biomarkers, are in the near infrared. So by having a large telescope, the inner working angle can allow us to actually reach this wavelength. We also have much better data quality for characterization. The spectra are higher quality.
Again, reminder, folks, please put your microphone on mute. Somebody is having their potato chips for lunch, which we can hear. Thank you so much.
Harley, can once in a while, can Olivier or someone announce the slide number?
Good.
Yeah, I'm on the YB apertures slide, which is slide number 4. So another thing that's really nice with bigger apertures, you have better astrometry. So to measure the orbits and dynamical masses, this is very helpful. We also get a better image resolving power for the exodiacal light, which is interacting with the exoplanet. So all of these are things that we can put numbers behind, and then there are things that are harder to quantify. Overall, when we have a system with multiple planets, clumps of exodiacal light, angular resolution is really key to separate those features. So this is something that's very important and larger apertures give us. We also have more photons, more light, which means we have more ability to do PSF calibration. So we can actually trade off a little bit of contrast versus aperture using this. This is what I'll show in the next slide. Another thing that's very interesting is that if you have a bigger aperture, there's a wider range of stars, of stereotypes around which you can detect habitable planets. So you start to get a more diversity in your data set. This is illustrated here. Maybe if we can turn off the light for 1 second, few seconds. And it's a very complicated graph, which has more dimensions than I can count here. shows the location of hypothetical habitable planets. So it assumes that each star has a habitable planet. So it's a planet like the Earth in its habitable zone. And here I put them in two dimensions. Contrast here, log contrast, 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 10. And this is angular separation, log arc second. So this is one arc second, one tenth of an arc second, one hundredth of an arc second. And you can see that they're not all sitting at the same spot. A lot of us used to think of habitable planets are sitting at about 10 to minus 10 contrast, and typically for nearby stars, maybe a tenth of an arc second. That only is generally true for nearby sun-like stars. But if we look at a more distant star, the points move this direction. The size of the circle is actually inverse proportional to the distance to the system in this plot. So big circles like alpha, tan, A, and B are here, and then the circle gets smaller as the star gets further away. But the more interesting is the color of the plot, which is the spectral type is encoded in the color of the circles. So M-type stars, their habitable zone is very close in to the star, means that you have to get better angular resolution. But the contrast is not as challenging because the planet is in closer to its star. So you get, this is a Proxima Centauri, you get a contrast of not too far from 10 to the minus 6 for a habitable planet. And you can trade off angular resolution, so inner working angle versus contrast. And if you have a telescope, that gets you better angular resolution, you can catch a wider range of population of habitable planets. Yes?
Are those blue circles in the top left white dwarfs?
Yes. Okay. Yes, so there's a few white dwarfs here. I have no idea if they have.
Habitable planets?
But we can look. They're actually a little faint. They're a little faint to do the wavefront control, but I didn't take that into account. So I'll get back to this diagram a little bit later. So the problem is when we think about large telescope diameter and we try to quantify how much more science we gain, there starts to be potential issues that we don't, a lot of us don't fully understand. We can scale yields and data quality more easily on small apertures because we understand better the technology largely speaking, the efficiency of the system, the inner working angle in units of lambda over d are sort of independent of telescope aperture. The contrast gets better if you have a large telescope initially because you get more light to do the waveform control, and more importantly, you have enough light to reach the contrast because it's a 10 to minus 10 contrast on a 1 meter telescope, except maybe if you look at Sirius for a very long time, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. There's not enough photons to actually measure anything at that level. But the big question is, what happens when we talk about especially segmented aperture, 8 meter and above, what are those numbers turning out to be? And that's very important because people compute science yield and data quality needs those numbers to inform us on how much science we can do. Yes?
Those curves are going down, getting worse to the right of that figure because the mirrors, the telescope is made differently?
I'm not making any claim here.
Right.
There are two curves. There's the ones that are flat.
Right.
And
just saying we don't know if it's going to be one, the other, something.
This chart is mostly a reflection of perception.
Okay.
Perceptions in the community. So you know, the optimistic people like me are the solid lines. People that think it's more like this. Okay. So let's look at this problem, and I'm going to start by looking at really the fundamental of the theory based on the nature of light, which is basically electric field interfering. So I'm just going to use one concept, which is very powerful, is that all of the optical systems we design, all chronographs, they're all linear in complex amplitude. And this is always true when you do a Fourier transform, you go from a tribune plane to a focal plane, it's a linear transformation. And then it's all about light interfering with light. So everything is linear and complex amplitude. So if you want to see the details, there's a paper that I and several other people published on this. But you can build a model, say, well, basically a chronograph, any optical system is essentially a matrix multiplication of your input complex amplitude. And you get an output complex amplitude. And then you square it to get intensity. That's what your detector does. And you some of the vector, some of the elements in that vector are discarded because they are light that falls on the focal plane mask, for example, and some of them are useful. They're the ones in the dark hole. And just using this simple assumption, you can actually drive very strong conclusions about what chronographs can do. And you can even visualize things geometrically, and you can look at the paper for more detail, but you can tell that because it's a linear operator and it must cancel the light from the star, from the on-axis star, it essentially does a projection perpendicularly to that direction on the hyperplane that's perpendicular to the star complex amplitude component. And that tells you what the chronograph can do and cannot do. So one very simple result, but very powerful, is that essentially because the chronograph, the ultimate limit of the chronograph is independent of contrast, and it's basically, you can express it as and you can get 100% throughput, but the inner working angle is going to be constrained because you need to capture the light from the on-axis star. The source that's very close to the star is very similar in complex amplitude to the star because you need to cancel the star. You will also cancel the component of that other vector that can be projected along the star vector. And so the conclusion you get is the theoretical throughput you can get out of chronograph at high contrast is 1 minus the area pattern, essentially. So that's shown here. That's basically throughput, and that's how much light you can maintain on the off-axis point source versus angular separation. If it's a point source, which is here the 0 lambda over d line, the maximum throughput is this line, and you can get an inner working angle of about half a lambda over d if you follow that theoretical limit.
So that's just an area difference.
Exactly, inverted.
Okay.
Now, the problem, so another thing that this actually, so this result is largely independent of contrast. You need to cancel minus 5 or 10 to minus 10, you're going to get the same curve. There's another thing that's very interesting is when you actually take into account the stellar angular size, the chronograph job is not just to cancel the vector that corresponds to an axis, all right, but it must cancel a bunch of vectors that are close together, but it must cancel them at a deep level, so it starts to have to cancel more than one mode. And those additional modes that it needs to cancel to deal with stellar angular size start to look similar to the component that corresponds, for example, to one lambda over d of axis source. So you find out that just by increasing, this is a 10 to minus 10 contrast, just by increasing the size of the star just a little bit, let's say from 0 lambda over d to 0.1 lambda over d, you increase the inner working angle, the theoretical best inner working angle you can get out of the choir at that contrast level, to basically almost 2 lambda over d. So this is a very fundamental limit. You cannot do better than that because you're constrained by the linearity in complex amplitude. Some of us, including me, actually early on thought, well, if we have a star, if we have a star that's 0.1 lambda over d, we ought to find a chronograph for which the inner working angle just increases by 0.1 lambda over d. That's what the geometrical understanding of chronography would lead you to believe. That's wrong. There's no solution to that. You cannot do that. You have to actually, because of linearity in complex amplitude, partially resolved star will actually drive the inner working angle quite far. Now, you can trade off. You can say, well, maybe I have a large system. Maybe I don't need 10 to minus 10. I can do 10 to minus 8, and I'll gain the rest by PSF subtraction. And you can do that if you want to get inward of 2 lambda over d. But there will be some loss of efficiency for a very small angular separation if you have an extended source. Now, I'll get to that a little bit later. It's not as bad as it sounds, because if you're interested in habitable planets, this never happens. You never have a 0.1 lambda over d disk, and you look for something at 2 lambda over d, because that's way inside the habitable zone. But this is something to keep in mind. So the conclusion of this is, well, the theory tells us, I should mention, which is very important here, that this theory does not tell us that segmented aperture are any different fundamentally from unobstructed friendly aperture. Those curves, the shape of those curves would be slightly different because the area pattern is slightly different, the diffraction pattern is slightly different. But by and large, the inner working angle you can choose is going to be about the same. The theory tells you you should be able to achieve the same contrast, essentially limited by waveform control, not by a chronograph design. And you should be able to have 100% design. The fundamental limits are not at the level, are not imposed by the shape of the aperture. They're imposed by a strict limit on inner working angle, which has a strong dependence on the stellar angular size of your source. So, but that's just theory. So the next step was, where can you build those chronographs? And you can. You probably would not want to, at least in the way that I show here. You can take that linear operator that this theory produces, and you can actually build it as a series of beam splitters and discrete interference between beams. It's hugely complicated. You would never want to build some, or especially fly something like that, but it's a proof of existence of an optical way to actually achieve this limit. So this is very interesting because it really fundamentally tells us that there's no reason for us as a community to stop working on segmented aperture because there is some golden rule of optics that say it won't work. That's definitely not true. So before I jump into much more practical consideration, let's keep dreaming a little bit longer. What would this actually do? If we actually managed to build reach this limit, what could we do? And the fancy would be really amazing because those are numbers that you can look at the paper for the detailed assumption. Essentially, with an 8-meter telescope, there would be about 1,000 stars you could around which you could look for habitable planets. And to do that would only require to sample those 1,000 stars would only take 4 months of open shutter time. We do not have systems that or even concepts yet that reach this number, but this is sort of giving us maybe a long-term goal, or at least a limit to what we can do that includes all of the fundamental physics. And so there's a very strong potential. Now I'm going to jump away from theory and go into a much more concrete things now. I'm going to talk about W first, because this is really a very good success story for our ability to solve this problem on segmented aperture. This is a history of chronographs on unfriendly aperture, so I'm on slide 13. So there used to be a time when most people would agree with that statement, that directly imaging habitable planet requires a monolithic unobstructed aperture, that the diffraction from spiders or edges, at least at the 10 to minus 9, 10 to minus 10 contrast, is a huge challenge that has no practical solution. And this drove, for example, TPFC and also smaller emission concept studies at that time to use off-axis telescopes. But already at that time, there were a few ideas that seemed compatible with centrally obscured aperture. One of them was the VNC, for example, visible non-ring chronograph. I'll talk a little bit more about it. But the major opinion was that you really couldn't practically deal with a pupil like this. And then, a few years ago, we had the AFTA challenge, where we had, as a committee, we had to find a solution for chronographs on this aperture to survive. Essentially, we did not have the possibility to choose our aperture. This is what we had to work with. And in a very short amount of time, several concepts actually matured, not to get to the optimal efficiency of chronograph on this kind of aperture, but to get decent solutions to get to the 10 to minus 9, 10 to minus 10 contrast with this type of aperture in fairly realistic environments. So with waveform errors, not perfect optics, and a waveform control that fixes that. So three credible options were down-selected for further technology demonstration. The baseline for the AFTA chronograph are the shaped UP chronograph and hybrid UP chronograph, and there's also a backup. Which is the PAZMC one I work on. So there's three existent proof of chronographs that can work and can deal with it. But some of them were basically concepts that were originally designed for unobstructed aperture that had to be modified to deal with aperture in ways that reduce the efficiency. So, and it depends on the concept, but the shaped pupil and the HLC lost some efficiency by having to be adapted to this pupil, but they were the most mature option. The PACMC, which is technologically maybe about a year behind in development, doesn't suffer as much from the segmented aperture, and I'll tell you that there are more concepts coming that also don't care as much. So let's look at the concepts. So this is one that recently emerged. The apodized pupil chronograph is not very new, but only recently people have really worked hard to figure out if they could make it work on a segmented aperture. And the conclusion was yes, and they have very interesting, credible solutions now. So this is a simulated image. The inner working angle in this example is 4 lambda over d. The efficiency is not too bad. It's about 30%, but the contrast is great. It's 10 to the minus 10, and it's also quite insensitive to stellar angular size, which is associated with the choice of inner working angle. And it looks quite manufacturable. It's basically using the same type of components that W-first AFTA is currently developing and planning to fly. Pupil plane apodizer. The focal plane mask is basically a simple hole in a mirror, so it's not too difficult to manufacture. And then there's a LEO stuff, and the shape and the shape of both the apodizer and the DM is optimized to basically the geometry of the pupil segment. So this is a simulated image of a 12 meter telescope looking at the solar system between at 13 parsec, where you would see V
What bandpass?
I think they use 10%.
Yeah.
In the 28% throughput, that's just the mask, right? That's not the, or that with all the options.
That's just the mask. Yeah. So you get additional loss in reflectivity. You know, this is a conceptual throughput.
It's 18%. 18%. The planet's light, 18% of it makes it through past the chronograph in the end, and that's not the amount in the core, that's the total.
Okay.
And you said it's credible, and then there's a demonstration of the 10 minus 10, or it's...
That's all in the computer for now, but this group and several other groups are starting to plan lab demonstration.
Yeah, how tunable is it? Say you want to look at a couple of different wavelengths.
I think that mostly you just have to change the focal plane mask size.
So you change focal plane mask if you want that.
I don't think their apodization map changes with wavelength, but that's a question to be directed to this group.
Well, do they have plans to try this out on the HC, high contrast imaging test bed?
There are. I think all of us would love this type of thing to be tested on HCIT, but HCIT is a bit busy right now with W1st-ASTA,
right.
So it's a matter of timing. I fully expect
they have their own. They have their own.
Yeah.
Aspect,
well,
right? Yeah.
Well, Mamadou is at the institute. Remy's lab is going to do some demos at the institute lab, but ultimately, I think they would like to get into HCIT because then they can do full simulation of everything.
Yeah, so the lab at Space Telescope is not in vacuum, so it's in air. So they can do testing at least to 10 to minus 7 contrast, maybe a little deeper. And where we'd like those things to go is then in a high-fidelity vacuum test space so that we can get the rest of the way in contrast.
But are there plans then to test it at HCIT?
There's no official plans, and I think it's contingent on the schedule.
Right.
On.
There's dialogue between Remy and JPL on this.
This would be great for W1st, which presently has an optical efficiency of 2 to 4%. But then you're
going to
revisit the
W1st
progress
question,
surely, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to revisit the
down select,
though, are they?
No. Unlikely, because of schedule constraints. Yeah. And this design is fairly new, so it's not at the level of maturity that the W1st designs are currently at.
But is this just a different DM solution?
No, it's really a co-optimization of especially the focal plane mask, the LEO stub, and the shape.
All three together.
Yeah. So those things are co-optimized together. And I'll talk a little bit more about similar co-optimization process in the chronograph that I'm working on. One of the great success also has been to understand with W1st ASTA that the waveform control system had some leverage on the starlight diffracted by spiders and central obstruction. That you could design a chronograph that gets you only part of the way, maybe 10 to minus 6 contrast, with a flat wavefront, and you can use the degrees of freedom having a wavefront control system to further cancel light diffracted by the segments and central obscuration. This is an example of this approach being taken quite far into contrast by Laurent Pouilleau and his team, where he's optimizing the shape of two DMs to cancel light diffracted by segment gaps and spiders, and you do get, you can build a very dark area in your PSF by using those degrees of freedom. So, not just the chronograph design can get you part of the way, but you can throw in also wavefront control to help with that problem. So that I think our community understands much better now that both of those can help, and the new chronographs are now co-designed with the waveform control system that goes with them. And then there are approaches that, at least on paper, seem to not care at all about segments. That because of the way they are designed, are on paper insensitive to the geometry of the pupil. One of them is the visible Nunling chronograph, which I'm sure you're very familiar with here, because it's been developed here, and so what you can do, what the visible nerd can do is basically shift the pupil by integer number of segments, and then do a destructive interference between those two copies. If you shift by an integer number of segments, the segments line up, so you actually don't lose anything by having segments. The gaps, the line, the gaps land on the gaps, so you don't really lose anything by a segment. Another one, that's the one I'm working on, is the PACMC, and I'll talk a little bit more in detail about how it works. But one thing that's interesting with the PACMC, it's one of the chronographs that has been down selected for further development for the W first half time machine. It's not the primary one, it's the backup one, but it does offer, because of that property that it really doesn't care much about the aperture geometry, it does quite well on AFTA, because it doesn't care performance-wise about the central obstruction and spiders. Just to illustrate this point, those are science efficiency metrics that were computed at JPL, so I'm not the one who computed this. I'm reporting results. There's a paper by Brian Kern that describes this. So this is the number of planets versus cumulative on target time between the HLC and the PL, and you get a big gain. You get so you can look at it in two ways. You can keep the number of exposure time the same and compare the number of planets, or you can keep the number of planets the same and look at how much exposure time you need to get those planets. And this is for the hybrid LEO and the shape you build. One thing that emerges with a higher performance chronograph is you get a lot of benefit when you look at the longer range, the longer wavelength range where you want to do spectroscopy, for example, in near infrared, because the near working angle moves up proportionally to lambda. And this particular concept has an inner working angle of 1.2 lambda over d, so it's very goes in very close. So you can work in the near infrared. Here, this is very, very near infrared, 890 nanometer. But you still have basically about 15 planets, known orbit planets that you can follow at that wavelength. Whereas here, as a comparison, here you basically have three. So and those are the numbers. Another thing that emerges from this, which is connected to the plot I showed you with all of those circles, colorful circles, if you can get closing in inner working angle, you have access to much brighter planets. And for those planets, the exposure time to do characterization is very short because they're really bright. The size of this circle is encoded in relation to the brightness of the planet. If you have a chronograph that works at 4 lambda already in Osborne, you are limited to quite faint planets. Your exposure time should be quite long if you can work at 1 to 2 lambda over D. You have very bright planets you can access. They are the Jupiter-sized planets that are sitting quite close to their star, and the reflected light is very bright, so your exposure times are very short. And that's the main reason why there's a big gain. If you look at how much time it takes for three planets to be characterized at this wavelength, with SPC here, it's 20 days, and with PR, for those three planets, it's less than a day. That big difference is not explained by by efficiency of the chronograph, because relative efficiency of the chronograph don't give you that large a factor. It's explained by the fact that they are not the same three planets. In this case, those three planets are out here. They're quite faint. In this case, those three planets are up here. They're quite bright, so you can do characterization. They're different planets. You can do characterization much quicker. So this is connected to some of the things I'm going to come back to at the end of my talk. As a very positive note, there are groups already. So there's a group at Space Desktop. I also lead a team at University of Arizona. We're building testbeds to test those things in the lab in air, so not at the very high contrast level, but at the sort of 10^-7 contrast level, and also, equally important, understand how we do waveform control on segmented aperture that are linked to chronographs. So I'm going to now talk about specifically one of those chronographs that compatible with segmented aperture. I'm going to talk about it because I work on it. And that's the PIA-TMC, phase-induced amplitude opposition complex mask chronograph. This is how it works. So it uses three steps. The first step is to do an appositization. So it's very similar to the APLC concept that I described. For the first step is to do an appositization. So you make the edges of the beam fainter than the center. But instead of doing it by putting a selective absorption mask, we do it by reshaping the lines with aspheric optics. So essentially, it's like a pair of lenses or mirrors that have variable magnification when you move from the center to the edge. At the center, we tend to squeeze light in a smaller area. We make it brighter in surface brightness, and at the edge, we stretch it up. And you need two optical elements to do that and maintain a flat wavefront at the output. So you go from this to this image.
Can you, as we go through this, sort of explain why you're doing that? Like, is it because there's a lot of energy where the diffraction is occurring, so you want to push the energy away from what's diffracting?
The original PIA concept was only doing this, right? And then you had an image where you had no area ring. And the idea was the area rings really come from the edges of the aperture. You do a Fourier transform of a disk, you get an area ring, and you get rings because you have sharp edges. So if you suppress the edges, if you make the edges soft, you're not going to get rings. So that was the original PIA concept. It has evolved to a higher performance variant where we don't do a full appositization, we do a partial appositization. We still have rings, but they're not as bright as the normal PFF. And then we put a focal plane mask, which actually phase shifts the center of the PFF. And we compute those things carefully together so that the light that passes through the focal plane mask, that is phase shifted, and the light that passes around destructively interfere in the pupil. And so you have to trust, to some extent, the computer to optimize this.
But is it true, though, that you are trying to redistribute the energy away from the edge? And therefore, if you go to segments, you don't just want to do it at the edge boundaries, but you also want to do it along all the segment edges?
No. And this image really shows what happens.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it does.
It doesn't care about the edges, because when we go through this process and we look where is the starlight, it's completely dark in the segments, inside the segments, and it's bright in the gaps. So essentially, it's because that interference, that the light that passes through this mask that has been phase shifted, essentially takes this and subtracts to it a large Gaussian, so it drives all of the white areas to zero.
Okay.
And all of the black areas to minus.
You figure out what your phase shifting circular mask looks like, and then you work backwards to say, what pupil would I like? You create that.
Yes.
Okay.
So the design step is we fix the focal plane mask size, then compute the opposition that will match, that will create the disruptive interference between those two components.
And so it's not that related to the segmentation.
It doesn't care about the segmentation. As long as your real stuff masks the gaps, the spiders, and the central selection. But that's very easy to do. So that's how the design works. Is really so three components, the appositization, which we choose to do with aspheric optics, but we could do it with normal masks. There would be an efficiency hit if we did with normal mask and an angular resolution hit also. A focal plane mask, which is in this monochromatic ideal concept, is simply a phase shifting mask with partial transmission, and it's just to balance those two components so that we have a disruptive interference and a Leo stop at the back end.
And that destructive interference is sort of analogous to what the visible nuller is doing in a sense, right? I mean, it's doing nulling.
Yes. Except that we do it in so the visible nuller splits in two beams.
Yeah.
And does you can sit in front of it and you can almost watch the destructive interference. Here it's a little more subtle because it's part of the focal plane mask area that interferes with another part. And that's the reason why we need to appositize, is because the Fourier transform of that mask is essentially a Gaussian-like growth function. So to make those two waves cancel perfectly, we do need to work with an appositized pupil.
So I've always been a little confused by why you call it phase-induced. I mean, you're really exploiting the Fourier transform of Gauss to the Gaussian, right?
The phase-induced is probably a very poor choice of name for the fact that the app- polarization doesn't come from a mask, it comes from two optics which have OPD surface.
And they're shaping
them to make
sort of a Gaussian.
Yes.
Is there a theoretical? So, like, the mirrors can be very high reflectivity.
Yes.
So, are we losing light at the transmission mask?
No, because the planet, there's no masking of the planet in phase or amplitude. So, in this idealized concept, the throughput is 100%. Not ignoring coatings. For the planet, and the inner working angle can be pushed to about 0.5 lambda over d, but that actually is not built. That wouldn't work very well for reasons I'm going to explain.
So it's a mis, because a lot of people have this conception that segmented chronographs have lower throughputs.
That's specific to some chronographic approaches.
Right.
Yeah. Not applied to
traditional, you know, image plane. Stops or cut light out, but in pupil plane, so the pupil plane approach, at least this one, there's no throughput loss.
There is no, there's no throughput loss, so your throughput is still 100%, and it doesn't really care that the aperture is segmented or not.
And it doesn't modify the PSF?
No.
Inverse transform it back.
Because we actually, so this is interesting, this is the, I didn't explain this, but that beam shaping does not do very nice things to affect the PSF, because you take a flat tilted wavefront, you squeeze closer the center and stretch the edges, you get something with a high slope in the center and sort of flattens at the edges. So if you look at a PSF for a planet out there, looks like a pineapple. So it's not great. But actually, if you look at a PSF at 2 lambda over d or 3 lambda over d, it's better than the airy PSF, because the diffraction rings are attenuated compared to the normal PSF. So if you look at planets at maybe 3, 4, 5 lambda over d, you actually gain by doing this shaping. You have higher, more light in the PSF core than a normal aperture. But then if you look at 10, 15, 20 lambda over d, it's the other way around. You're back, you lose. So if you want wide field, you can put this inverse optics that undo this remapping, and you'll have exactly what you had with your normal telescope pupil. If you want higher performance close in, you can remove this, but you lose further out. So that's a trade. Those optics are not particularly difficult because they're after the chronograph. By optical instrument standard, they're still very narrow fields, so they can be just a pair of small lenses. And you can include them or not. And if you don't include them, you have slightly higher efficiency closing. And I draw them as lenses, but on space missions we are thinking they'll be mirrors, not lenses. Because
99.something% we put there.
Chromaticity and ghost is a big concern with lenses. So on ground based PA systems we use lenses because we're not going after 10 to 9 contrast. And it's very convenient because you can drop the lenses in the beam. So you can have filter wheels that hold the lenses and have multiple chronograph modes, of which PA is one of them. So on the Subaru instrument, that's what we do.
What about the sensitivity to things like the reflectivity uniformity of the pupil?
So it is just like any other chronograph. It is sensitive to those things. There's no difference in terms of reflectivity on the pupil. It's just as sensitive as other chronographs. But if you work close in, you have the additional requirement that you also care more about what happens on the reflectivity uniformity at those special frequencies. But if you think about what will throw light at 5 lambda over d, whether it's PIA or another chronograph, and you're worried about coating uniformity, the requirement is going to be the same because there's a relationship between coating reflectivity and uniformity and contrast. But in reality, you also have to factor in the waveform control system, how it can compensate for that. So if you only have 1 dm, your requirement is going to be tighter. If you have 2 dms, you can start to have leverage on amplitude.
Deal with it that way. Okay.
So you can make up for, if you find yourself that the on coding uniformity that the requirement is a little hard to match. You gain by having two DMs, because then you can recover most of that. So this are some lab results that we obtained, not on the segmented aperture. This was on FCID. And the interesting thing here is that it goes to, so basically this is the position of the star, and we do get to 2 lambda over D. So it's been demonstrated in the lab at fairly high contrast. And the nice thing about this is done without losing the angular resolution of the telescope. So we use the full light. I'm going to skip to slide 29. The previous slides were just step-by-step description, but I already explained it. This is the design process for a real full coronagraph like the one we designed for ASTA. We start by doing exactly what I described, which is what I call an idealized monochromatic design for a centrally obscure aperture. So we basically start by computing the we choose a focal plane mask size, and that tells us what apodization we need to have, what is the function that's matched to that mask. Then we can design the optics that realizes apodization, and then we can go to the next level where we put that in a diffraction propagation model, and we can optimize the Leo stops for that. And then we go from this centrally obscure circular symmetric pupil, and we add all of the other things, spiders, segments. And we enter another loop which essentially perturbs the PIA optics shape to reduce the speckle intensity and redesigns the Leo stops and also tweaks the focal plane mass transmission. So essentially we go from that ideal design and we perturb it to work well on a segmented aperture using this loop. And then we have a design that works very well, but only in monochromatic light, and it works for that segmented aperture. And then we achromatize it by modeling the focal plane mask not just as a mathematical disk of some transmission and some phase shift, but by making it as a real component with a real material, and making it as a series of steps over a disk, and optimizing by computer the height of those steps. That is what the focal plane mask looks like. If you look at it from the top, this is the height of the features, and it's about 1.5 lambda over D in radius, which is about 100 microns, a little less than 100 microns in radius. And there are about 1,000 steps, each at a different height. And the computer optimizes the height of those steps, so the multiple interference between the light that passes through those 1,000 zones is creating an achromatic null. Because we can't make a mask like the one in the computer that we have, that's a disk, that's of a fixed number of lambda over D at all wavelengths, and has a fixed transmission and a fixed both in phase and amplitude as a function of wavelength. There's no material that does that. So we choose to realize it with these steps. Yes?
So it's 1,000 zones there and 100 microns, like 3 microns for each one of those features. How important are the edges of the steps? Do they have to be clean? Can they be rounded?
They can be rounded to some extent. And I've got some... So this is actually not just the simulations, it's an actual picture of a mask that was made.
How do you make them? What's the technique?
Is it lithography?
Microlithography,
yes.
You just do layers, you keep layering on
it. So one single material,
right.
So the process has multiple steps, but there's the final product, we actually make it as a mirror. So we etch.
Oh, you're etching.
Photoresist, okay. And then we, MDL does that, that GPL, okay. Coat it with a reflective coating. And that seems to work fairly well.
I got you.
Yeah.
And so how sensitive are these focal plane masks to jitter? Are they very
so this
sensitive?
This is a 3D view of the model of the focal plane. I'll get to that.
Yeah, okay.
So this When I first designed this, this looks very scary, right? Because it's a lot of zones, but it turns out it's been made and characterized. This was our last milestone for the W1st chronograph, and it passed the milestone. So the, on the first iteration of making these maps, they were actually good enough for broadband wavefront, broadband high contrast imaging of that stuff. Yes.
Why don't I see symmetry in this? So, you know, pupil masks have obvious symmetry with respect to whatever the input pupil is. Here it seems all random to me. I don't.
I did not build the symmetry into the model of the mask, and I did not clock those zones to the axis of symmetry of the spiders. So you do not expect mathematically perfect symmetry, but you would expect.
So the spiders are asymmetric, so it's yeah.
Right.
Well, they're
not aligned everywhere.
It is surprising how much it asymmetrizes. So. Yeah.
So this has a very specific rotation relative to the pupil.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So you have to clock it to basically the spiders.
Yeah. So it's a complex Fourier transform between that and pupil. Is that right?
But what this really does is it emulates what the computer told us the focal plane mass should be. The focal plane mass should be a partial, let's say, it should be maybe 50% transmissive, should be a perfect disk, and it should have a pi phase offset at all wavelengths. The problem is there's no material that does that. If you try to do it with some material, the transmission is going to be wavelength dependent, the phase shift is going to be wavelength dependent, and the size of the mask will not be fixed in lambda over d because the PSF grows proportion to lambda. So we basically asked the computer to try to emulate that by multiple interference between light that passes through small zones. And we're not trying to, this is a complete blind process. We just tell the computer, find the set of heights for this little zone that will create the dark interference inside the pupil. And it seems to work. That's what it comes up with. And then we make the mask to quantify how well the manufacturing process was matched to the requirement for the mask. Again, the process was not, this is the design of the mask, and these are the list of requirements for how good the mask needs to be, because we did not understand on the first try, we did not understand what kind of errors we were going to get out of the manufacturing. So instead, made an ideal mask, designed it, MDL made it, then we measured it with, so this is work that folks at JPL did, especially Brian Kern. This is what the mask looks like in a phase shifting interferometer, and this is 155 micron diameter, so you don't have a very good resolution. This is atomic force microscope, and this is electron microscope, so we measured it at different scales. This is for the AFM data. This is a linear cut through the center part of the mask, and you can see overlaid the theoretical desired profile and the measured profile. And most of the error, especially this difference between the blue and the red, is actually due to the measurement of the AFM. So it's probably a little better than those transitions, a little sharper. And we do see that when we look at the electron microscope. So what we did is we actually took this data and put it in a waveform control simulation of the whole chronograph with realistic error on all the optics, and that's how we verified that the mask was good enough.
So basically, if you make a better mask, more rect function mask, how much do you think the contrast could improve?
I have the curve here. I did not explain it, but there was a curve here. This line is the raw contrast from that mask.
Okay.
So this is 10 to minus 9, 10 to minus 8.
Okay. That order of magnitude.
Yeah. And this is the first mask we did. So actually it's pretty promising. The other thing that's nice is that the error, that the dominant error that limits the contrast, has nothing to do with the mask itself. It has something to do with the stitching pattern that's outside the mask. So because the multiple exposures needed to be stitched, and outside of the mask there's a square that you can see a transition zone. That's the main contributor to this, and that's I'm told that that's quite easy to fix. There's a different setting for the machine that has wider field of view where we can push that further up.
Like e-beam lithography,
yeah.
And they're going bigger.
Yes. And this was the very first mask we made, so it was quite reassuring that the first mask passed the milestone. Another thing that I didn't mention is that when we actually this is with a perfect mask in a computer simulation, this is the contrast versus angular separation. So this is the raw contrast angular separation.
And what page are you on?
I am on page 30. So there are two. So this is in 10% band. So this is the mask is optimized to provide contrast in a broad band. So here it's 10%. It's basically at around 10⁻⁹. So it's a little, maybe it's 2⁻⁹ at 2 λ/B, and it's a little darker for us, but give or take at 10⁻⁹, which is exactly where you want to be for AFTA, because essentially. At 10⁻⁹ contrast on a 2.4-meter telescope, you don't have many photons to work with. So there are two curves here. One of the red curve is for a point source, and the green curve is for a result source. And the mask has been optimized to actually work on a result source, on a partial result source, because of jitter in the telescope and stellar angular size. Before we did that, when we did not do the optimization for the stellar angular size, when we just did it for chromaticity, the contrast was much worse. So this is, it used to be the black curve. So the black curve was our Gen 2 design. This was a 20% band. And it was only very partially optimized for extended source. We didn't do much of an optimization for extended source. And the contrast is almost 10⁻⁷. At basically 2 λ/D, and we dropped by more than an order of magnitude by doing a more aggressive optimization, not just for chromaticity, but for stellar angular size. So the computer, when it's designing those zones, is not just optimizing those zones to make the chronograph work in broadband, it's also optimizing it to work on a result star. So we simultaneously optimize for slightly different directions on the sky. And that gives us the total gain we get from that is a reduction of maybe 50 to 100 in contrast, in the contrast term associated with jitter and stellar angular size. So that's very relevant for the large telescopes because we're going to need to push this even further.
Actually, I was going to ask, Lee was saying that if you can make a better mask or if you have a magnification, so you can have the same physical feature size, but it's a bigger mask. Do you get significantly better performance, or that's something that you're still looking into?
Well, yes, you would, because you would get so the if you recall what we got was at about 10⁻⁸, and the model is about 10⁻⁹.
Yeah.
So you'd get a factor of 10 improvement by just making the manufacturing better.
How sensitive are you to focus?
Not significant. So this has been looked at as part of the validation for the Gen 3 design. At the scale at which we expect focus to change on W first, we're okay. But if you expect more change, then what we would do is when we design this mask, we would actually add a focus variations in its optimization. We would say, okay, now don't just design for tip tilt jitter, but also focus, and then.
It also looks like you have to align it to nanometers initially, because if it's 100 microns wide, in order to get those things lined up.
No, the way it works is you do not need to align the PSF to the...
Oh, the DM? You take care of that at the DM?
Well, it's really, if you look at globally what happens over a zone, it's the interference between all those different steps that creates the desired effect. You could switch zones locally, and the mask would not change its behavior. It's really, you think about the center, for example. There is essentially a flat, the top of the area function is essentially a flat in intensity distribution falling here. Okay. What matters is not so much, oh, this zone is here instead of here. It's that those, the ensemble of those zones create the set of waves with the right dependency in wavelength that maintains the dark null over a broadband.
How does not, like, a vortex chronograph just kind of randomize?
So the vortex came at it from a slightly different angle. So you could actually take the vortex and the vortex design and say, okay, let's see what this process gives for the vortex. Can you achromatize the vortex focal plane mask with this principle? They chose a different path. They chose to use to build in achromaticity in the way they do the phase offset themselves. But essentially, this process was, let's design a chronograph that works perfectly in monochromatic light, but we know that the problem is the mask, the focal plane mask is not manufactured, it's not a physical focal plane mask, and let's just replace only the focal plane mask by this, asking the computer to emulate the behavior of the focal plane mask as a function of wavelength that is desired for the chronograph to work, and using those degrees of freedom which are on the steps of height. There's probably more clever ways to do it. It's a sort of a brute force approach of giving to the computer a lot of degrees of freedom, and we went in these directions because we knew that this could be made. We had a good idea this could be made, and we just tell the computer, figure it out. We know from the monochromatic design that there ought to be a solution. We don't know what it is, so... Okay, so back to large segment aperture, the same design, I showed you what it was for ASA. You can apply the same thing for segmented apertures. There's a few things that are different. You have to worry a little bit more about diffraction by the edges of the gap. So if you're like not perfectly conjugated to the pupil plane, you get a diffraction from the gap. This is, for example, what the light distribution looks like on the second PA optics. It looks... You're not in a pupil plane, so you get a lot of diffraction. But if you take that into account in the design, if you take this diffraction into account, it works quite well. The only caveat which, is that the LEO stuff typically needs to oversize a little bit around the gap to handle that diffraction, because you have physical optics that are not infinite in size, relaying the light from this plane to the end after the chronograph. So you do get a little bit of diffraction at the gaps, and so you need to mask that. This is why we don't have 100% throughput. We have 70%, which is still pretty good, but it's not 100%. And it's very, you can push it to about 80%, but it's very hard to go above because of those gaps. I made the gaps quite large here, so the gaps are narrower, you gain throughput. But the great thing is, it still is 1.7 over the working angle. And it has the same nice property as the design, the Gen 3 design for the very first ASTA. So it's very achromatic, and it also has built-in resilience to stellar angular size. Not as much as we want, and we need to keep working on that, but a lot better than the idealized mathematical mass that was just a disk.
What do you mean by fairly achromatic? Can you be more specific? 10%?
10 to minus 9 contrast in 10%. Bandwidth. And so this is the design that I did. I did not try to extend the bandwidth, but I can predict what would happen from experience on the W-first design where we extended the bandwidth. We managed to also maintain 10 to minus 9 in 20% band, but we had to start trading off sensitivity to jitter, to stellar angular size, against broadband performance. And you can trade those things off, and there's probably a lot more to do on the optimization of the mask itself to push the performance deeper. But it looks so 10 to minus 9 is in 10 to 20% bandwidth is what we have right now. And on an expanded source, the image you get has actually the signature of the most of that light here, this is 10 to minus 10 is around here. So this field is at about 10 to minus 9. But it is brighter very close in because of stellar angular size. So this is a simulated image with a resolved star. And
Yes.
I just want to make a comment that, so it sounds like on WFIRST you were given a jitter, which is why you had to make that trade-off. But for, say, at last, we could work it the other way around. We will want you to optimize to get the best contrast. You tell us the jitter you need.
Yes.
And we'll give you that jitter.
There is there's one thing we can change. It's the stellar angular size, which behaves exactly like a jitter. But it actually is less of a problem than it seems. This looks bad, right? Because I made the star kind of big. I forget exactly the value, and the contrast at 2 lambda over d is not good. It's basically 10 to minus 8, or even brighter, it's a few times 10 to minus 8. But if you're thinking about habitable planet, it's not going to be here, because I made the star partially resolved. The habitable planet is going to be sitting further up. And if you make the star, in any case, you never have the requirement that when the star is really big, you want to work at small inner working angle, because the habitable zone is never going to be there. But that's, it's still something we want to optimize, because when I do simulated image of extrasolar planets, habitable zone planets, that is very often a dominant term in the contrast budget. So that drives the exposure times longer, because we have to beat down the photon noise from this. Those are simulated images. I showed this one before. This is the APLC concept, very insensitive to jitter, and it works at 3.6 lambda over d in a working angle. With PR, you can get 1.2 lambda over d in a working angle, which means that you can look at the same system in near infrared and get this image. So the science benefit here is really getting a spectra all the way to the near infrared for nearby exo-Earths. What you can also do is look much further out in the visible wavelength. So here you can actually pull out an Earth at a distance of 40 parsec, which you couldn't do with this design, because the Earth would be inside of the inner working angle. So you have those two benefits. You can go for a lot more targets, you can go further, or you can look at the targets that are nearby, but extend the spectra into the near infrared.
Just for reference, it's the same underlying input model in all three.
Yes, except I think it is, except that there's a flip in the axis.
Yeah, between those two. Yeah, okay. Right, so we are comparing this apple and apple.
Can you just switch out the optimized mask to the, you know, have a mask for nearby stars and have a mask for stars at 10 parsecs?
To some extent. I haven't looked at this, actually. So this is something that we need to design, a mask where you, if you look at a nearby target, maybe you want to get better contrast here, but larger inner working angle.
Right.
I haven't looked at that. You can probably do that.
Just have two channels and switch between.
This is just a zoomed version of the same image. I'll finish by talking about wavefront control. So, I hopefully have convinced you there's nothing wrong with a segmented aperture for chronography. You can do high-performance chronography. Done. So I showed an example where we designed something that goes to 1.2 lambda over d in a working angle, which would have a tremendous science yield on a large aperture, and also combined with a very high throughput. But another problem is the segment vibration is the wavefront stability on the segmented aperture. I'm not going to go over this slide because I'll jump straight to solutions. One of the things that seems to be a very good strategy is to use the bright starlight to do linear wavefront sensing. This is used on AFTA. It's called the low-order wavefront sensor. The light that the coronagraph wants to reject, you use it. There's a lot of it, and you use it to measure low-order aberrations. We pioneered that on the super telescope on a SkyXO instrument, and we typically correct about 10 modes on Sky, and this is traces, time traces. This is a number of frames. This is in the labs. This is tilt focus and 2STIG, and this is on Sky. And when we close the low-order sensor loop, it basically keeps those low-order modes are rock steady. The PSF stays centered behind the coronagraph mask, and we see very little, just at the inner working angle, we see very little variation of the light, and this is another result. This is on Sky again, and this is on 10 modes, 10 Xernity modes. Again, so we close the loop. I think it's not hard to tell when the loop gets closed. It's right here. And then the traces get very flat because that control loop keeps the low order modes essentially
and
rock steady.
What speed is that for SkyClear or for this data?
It's the sampling is done at 170 hertz, and we're limited by the speed of our camera.
Yeah.
We would like to go faster. So it's actually significantly slower than the visible loop, which runs at 3.5 kilohertz.
Right.
So it's interesting because on a ground-based system, the visible loop does very well, but then because it's centered in the visible, there is a 2% difference in refractivity of the index of refraction of the air between visible and infrared, so you're left with a differential chromatic tilt, and that's what this fixes. Another technique that's very close to low order sensor is to use, again, linear light that the chronograph normally does not use or reject in a linear control loop. This is a PA lab result, and this is in different wavelengths. So the dark hole is really dark here and here, but when you move outside the science band, you start to get a lot of light, and further out you go, the more light there is. That light, it turns out, is encoding the wavefront variations as well. And it's encoding them in a linear way, not a quadratic way like it is here. So if you change the wavefront, speckles appear here. And if a speckle appears, you have no idea what phase it is, because essentially it's a quadratic relationship. You start to, you see the square modulus of the complex amplitude appearing. But here it's interfering with a pattern that is already there because of the design of the chronograph. So you do get a linear dependence of this light in relationship to the wavefront aberration. So you can close the loop on that light, also on the light that is outside of your control region, to keep all of the modes frozen. It's very hard to create a speckle here without also creating speckles outside of your science band. There's essentially no aberration that can do things just in this band, or very little aberration without doing something outside of your science band. So you can use the light that the chronograph would normally reject in a linear loop, which is very fast, to control the wavefront. And the main advantages in doing this is that instead of requiring diversity, instead of requiring your DM to be poked several times to solve for what the aberration is, you can work out of a single image. And you have 100% science duty cycle. You don't need to perturb the wavefront to do your measurements. You do it while you're actually taking your prime science data. And it's got other advantages. But overall, what that buys you...
Are you integrating over that full, that bright patch? Is it like a pixel there is a pixel and the dark patch? Or is it you integrate over that whole region to build up signal and noise?
Essentially, you use that whole image as a wavefront sensor. There's a calibration step where you perturb the wavefront and you watch for these changes, this light pattern.
I see.
And you record that change.
Okay.
That's your response matrix. You invert that response matrix in a control matrix, and then all you do is you take those two images as every time you take an exposure, you multiply it by the control matrix and you feed back to the DM to keep the wavefront frozen. So the control is actually much simpler than EFC, for example, which has a solving step.
So if we only cared about tip-tilt, would we win? Would we improve our signal noise?
For tip-tilt, you wouldn't choose that. You would use the lower order, which is much better at measuring tip-tilt. And this would...
Well, I'm talking segment tip-tilt.
Yes, so you would measure segment tip-tilt here because this would actually turn into features in this
right.
region that you would recognize. And,
yes.
And if you're outside of the science band, those features are linearly coupled with the tip of the segment. So the main thing that it buys you is a much faster cycling for the wavefront control. So you relax your requirements on the stability of the wavefront by implementing schemes like this that use more of the starlight for wavefront sensing. And so those are some some numbers for W1st, but essentially on 19.5 star, we think we can do control at a bandwidth of about 10 minutes. This changes the way that you could operate W1st. The prime working scenario right now is you only do waveform control on bright stars, and then you freeze the state of the DM and go to your science target. That's very demanding on stability. But if you can use this to actually do waveform control on your science target, you're much less demanding of stability. And also, even if you don't do control, it's a good idea to store that data because it tells you what the waveform was doing during your exposure. It's very difficult for a speckle to be created in your dark hole without having a modulation also happen outside the spectrum, the science spectral band. So I think I'm out of time. I'll just mention that everything I've said, we also can apply it on ground-based telescope pupils. So this is a design that is really heavily over-designed for ground-based telescope. This is for the TMT, and the contrast is 3×10⁻⁹ in the absence of atmospheric turbulence. And this design actually uses real material, calcium fluoride lenses, and a transmission focal plane mask. This is just walking through the various planes. The LEO stop has actually several LEO stops because of the conjugation effect. There's a conjugation Z dimension in the due to the remapping of this. And this is my final slide. I'll just mention that there's an interesting complementarity between space and ground with this very high performance low inner working angle chronograph. In the ground, with very large apertures, you can target M-type stars, which are not too challenging in contrast, but require you to work very close in a working angle. And the combination of a large telescope, 30-meter aperture, with a 1 lambda over D inner working angle, gives you access to these targets for which the contrast is at about 10⁻⁷. And in space, you have access to more sunlight stars, essentially, warmer stars. But if you increase the telescope aperture in space, you also can cover a broader range on the sort of main sequence of stars. So that's my last slide. I think we have time for questions.
Yeah.
Sorry, I went a little bit over.
Sorry, we have...
Still, in the case of the folks online, time for questions. As long as folks want to stay.
I mean, I could start with a softball, which is, can you talk a little bit about either HDSD or LAS requirements, 10⁻⁰ contrast, et cetera, what do you see the prospects of getting there? What do you see as the tall poles?
As you can tell from my presentation, I'm actually quite optimistic about finding a chronographic solution that deals with the gaps in the segments. I think we already see some solutions. This is the one I described in detail, which its strength is that it's very high efficiency and small inner working angle, 1.2 lambda over D inner working angle. Its weakness is that we need to improve pointing jitter tolerance. Then I presented also the APLT option, which is very complementary because it's very sensitive to jitter. But its inner working angle is a little further out. So you have two very credible options. We also know the visible non-link chronograph conceptually does not care about the geometry of the pupil. I'm very optimistic on that side. I think the main risk that I see is that we do not have a waveform that is sufficiently stable to maintain a high contrast. It's maybe more of an engineering job.
We always say the chronograph is the hard part.
I don't think the chronograph is, well, from where I am, the chronograph is not the hard part. But if we think about the transition from, especially from the lab to a real large telescope, the main risk that I see is instabilities, vibrations. Especially because if we rely purely on starlight to do the waveform sensing and control loop, at the 10⁻⁹, 10⁻⁰ level, the bandwidth is not very fast. So fundamentally, we don't have enough photons to go very fast. We're talking about minutes, maybe on bright stars less than a minute, But any vibration that happens at 10 or 100 hertz, we will not have enough starlight photons to measure it to the level that we need to measure it if it is pushing the contrast above what our requirement is. So I think that's the main challenge. That's what I see that folks should be working on, as well as the coronagraph designs.
So the performance of W first coronography is going to be very influential, affecting the decade of 2020 through coronography and large telescopes to do this. Would you care to project what you think the W first performance will be?
Which
of your innovations will be folded into the real W first?
There are quite detailed models being done that predict the performance of W first. So there is a very good quantitative answer to your question. And roughly speaking, I don't have the plugs here, but W first will image and characterize known orbit planets and may have the sensitivity also go to smaller mass planets. That's also contingent on where those planets are.
Well, at this June ExoPAC meeting that you gave a talk on, Leslie Traub gave a talk comparing the science view of W first with the 1.4 meter XOC, which has the clear aperture, but smaller aperture, and the smaller aperture, clear aperture, had a higher science yield. But was he using different information than what you're giving us?
I'm guessing he was using the baseline chronograph on the very first, and possibly also our older Gen 2 design for PIA. So
he was.
Yeah. So. The answer to your question is if we there are different constraints for XOC and W-first. W-first is a very strict schedule, and so some of the things that I describe in my talk there's not enough schedule time to implement them or to mature them, to deploy them on W-first. So a lot of what I was talking about is not practically applicable to the W-first, but it's definitely applicable to the next mission after that. And when we look at that, it appears that segmented aperture do not significantly reduce the efficiency of coronagraph if we pick the right solutions.
So you showed a ATLAS design, I believe, 10 to the negative 9 contrast, and we're working at 1.2 lambda over D, 10% bandpass, 70% throughput. Can you talk to the manufacturability of that particular design?
So the best way to look at the manufacturability of this design is because it is essentially the same design as the very first Gen 3 PIA, which is right now in the phase where we validate the manufacturability with mass dose and lab demonstrations. So there's nothing about that design in terms of challenge of component manufacturability that is a function of the pupil geometry. So you can basically look at the W-first and track our progress on the W-first manufacturing of the component and in the lab demo that will be very active next year. And that can be transposed pretty reliably to another geometry.
So knowing that you haven't quite hit the theoretical limits yet with the W-first test, probably, you can assume that you're some factor of off in contrast to both of that.
So we have some, there's a lot of modeling going on, so we know some of those terms. So I showed you the focal plane mask. So on the first iteration where we made a focal plane mask, we measure how good that focal plane mask was in terms of contrast, final contrast. And so we understand those numbers. The other ones that are just Brian Kern has been computing this very recently is the quality of the optics, the PA optics. So, and we've been looking at diamond turn optics as a way to get the we're getting, the overall message is that with the current components that either we have in hand or a manufacturer send us error maps, measured error maps from a similar component, we're comfortable at the above 10 to minus 8 low contrast level. Going below that requires improvement on those components. I would guess that, you know, from, and most of it is really the focal plane mask, it's hard to anticipate how fast that development will happen, and you know, that contrast curve of fast will drop as a function of time. But so right now we're at 10 to minus 8, but this was our first attempt at making a focal plane mask.
Right.
So things will get better. Beyond that, I can't really, it's hard to be quantitative on future.
I think there was somebody on the phone.
Yeah, were there, again, questions for from folks on the phone?
Yeah, Stuart, I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, Olivier, how, from a P, from a PIA point of view, how important is it to, or how important is the secondary and the secondary supports relative to the, you know, the segmentation? Would it be advantageous, for example, to have an off-axis segmented telescope?
I don't think it would matter much. Based on the few cases of aperture geometry we've run, there doesn't seem to be a large performance variation that's driven by anything, any structure in the pupil. The caveat, the only thing that seems to happen is if you have a lot of segments, because we need to oversize in the Leo stuff, the masking in the gaps, you start to lose throughput. So on the case that I ran, the HDST pupil with fairly large gaps, we were at 70% overall throughput. And so if you made the gaps wider, or if you had more of them, the throughput would drop further. But unless you have crazy wide gaps and a lot of them, the throughput is going to stay pretty high. And there doesn't seem to be a dependence on the spiders or the central obstruction size.
Or the geometry of the segment?
We've only looked at hexagonal geometry, but I can't see that it would really matter. It's because the nature of this chronograph is that the light gets diffracted between the gaps. Whatever the gaps geometry are. So, for example, I did the design on GMT pupil. TMT pupil, they're vastly different than HDST and W-first.
Right.
And got very similar results for all of those pupils. There really wasn't any big difference in the performance. And those pupils are very different.
This is going to fall into the category of crazy thoughts, but I'm wondering, let's say you wanted to do real-time wavefront control with a high duty cycle all the time. Has anybody ever looked at deliberately injecting out-of-band light and using that? So let's say you want to look at 550 nanometers. So let's say you want to look at 550 nanometers, so instead you use a tunable laser to inject something really bright off-band and do the phase correction with that.
The challenge is you need to inject it so that it goes through your telescope.
Correct. You have to inject it, but the issue is, especially in space, overall the system is going to be highly stable. So I'm wondering if you inject it the same way every time, even though it's different than a plane wave coming from infinity, you might just end up with a different set of matrices, but be able to do just as well. And the advantage is you would have a...
So maybe at the center of curvature of the mirror.
Yeah, exactly. And you simply have one more matrix in the that you use in the math.
Yeah.
But you can now turn your source up as bright as you want.
That would solve our biggest problem. So, yeah, I think that would work very well.
We actually had an architecture for, we called it a spherical primary optical telescope, where we had a light source at center curvature. The problem is center curvature is twice the distance of secondary. So you basically need something that holds this point source stable that far away. So your secondary, instead of 10 meters, now you're looking at 20 meters away, you need a light, if you want to do it at center curvature. But that's what you'd be talking about. You need a way to hold the source stable.
I literally thought it now, so I haven't a clue how practical it is. But, you know, I'm imagining that as long as you inject it so that it's one more linear component in the system,
It doesn't necessarily have to be at the center of curvature. It just has to be the same every time.
Well, no, the problem is it has to somehow hit the primary mirror.
Yeah, you have to hit the primary mirror.
So you could inject it outwards, but you'd have to have a big flap to send it back in, or you've got to be somewhere out here and get it. You have to hit the primary mirror. Now, what the other thing people have done is put little holographic things at the edges of mirrors, so there might be some that measure mirror tilts.
There's a... Oh, sorry. Rick, hello?
How stable it has to be? You just have to hit the mirror, or do you have to, like, stay exactly in the right place?
It's a thing to study. I'm just curious if there's a way that, if you could just turn up the crank on the brightness, you could do the wavefront control all the time, which seems like it would be a really great thing.
So I think the right sequence is first, and we were talking about this earlier, we need to have some model of how the segments might vibrate or propagate it through a coronagraph, understand the requirement, and see if those requirements can be met on the engineering side, and if they can't easily, then what you propose.
And the other option is you just measure the segment to segment. Like, if you're dominated by tilt, segment tilt, which is, like on JWST, the wavefront error is dominated by segment tilt. So if you can reduce it down to one thing you're dominated by, and then you just measure that.
So
we've been thinking about
that's
that.
That's where I was going before I mentioned this one.
So we're thinking about doing that with laser metrology.
Yeah.
Does somebody have a question on the phone line?
Yes. This is Rick Lyon. Olivier, like in your approach, though, or one way of doing the wavefront control would be not to add a separate metrology source, but to use the light which you're pushing outside your dark hole, because that contains the wavefront encoded in it. In a nonlinear fashion, but there should be a way to, phase retrieve or back that information out. That would give you higher photon rates.
Absolutely. That's I didn't have time to describe it, but that's one of the two modes of this linear dark field control where you can use the light out of band or you can use the light out of the geometrical dark hole. It's a little harder to use the light out of the geometrical dark hole, especially if it's a 360-degree dark hole, because you can create speckles inside the dark hole that have very little effect outside of the dark hole. But if you do a half dark hole, it works much better because you can use the bright half. And if you have a phase error, it will modulate the bright half in a linear way, and you can close the loop on that. So there's some benefit to doing that. On the segmented aperture, it's even more interesting because there is actually a strong dependency between when a segment moves, it creates a very a pattern that has signature both inside and outside the dark hole. So you can do what you suggest. You can use the light outside the geometrical dark hole to measure in a linear way the segment motion.
That would give you orders of magnitude. I calculate this with a hand calculation, about four orders of magnitude of wavefront control increase in bandwidth because you're throwing away so much information from that. And so you'd be able to run at tens of hertz instead of minutes.
It does, as you pointed out, allow you to run quite a bit faster because there's a lot of light out there and it will be modulated by segment motion.
Yeah, my calculations were naive just because I'm assuming that the transfer function of all the spatial frequencies is uniform, but of course it's not. Because as you said, some of the speckles in the dark hole contribute very little information outside of it. And so,
I think the overall message is, and this is exactly what this plot shows, there's a lot of value in using the light that the coronagraph wants to reject because it does contain very good signal on the wavefront and most of the light is there. The coronagraph, if you look at the dark hole, it's a fraction of the focal plane field of view. It's a fraction of the total spectral bandwidth that the telescope gathers and only using that fraction for wavefront control is not very efficient, especially because it's the darkest place. So we make our job harder by working out of the null, which means anything we measure, we have to actually perturb the system. We have to add speckles. This is the EFC process. We have to break the dark hole several times in a row to get multiple images to actually solve for the wavefront, which works, but if we can use this light, this other light, it's much faster.
It gets us to the point where we're not in the thermal regime, but we're limited by the residual dynamic effect, the jitter, which is why if we could do laser metrology to get the jitter, and maybe do some calibrations where you put known changes to the mirrors, see what they do, and then measure the jitter as you take the observation, use that to calibrate out what's residual.
So I did not mention, but that, I think an important point is you need both, really, because the EFC is what you need to create the dark hole, because you need to close the loop on the pixels that you want to make dark, to get them dark. But once you reach that state, you then transition to using the bright light, whether it's from the lower wavefront sensor or from out-of-band, to maintain that state. Because it's very hard, and there's essentially very little can fall through the cracks. You have to imagine, okay, what could create a light here? What aberration could create light here without creating any modulation out of band or out of my dark hole or in the lower wavefront sensor? And the answer is there's very little that can do that. So it should work quite well. Of course, that needs to be stimulated. This is at the concept stage. We need to get it.
Well, if you were to pick out wavelengths that were slightly outside the science band, and then put each one at a different focus or something, then you would get the diversity that you'd need to sense it, but without actually dithering or modifying or stealing any of the science photons.
Yes.
So that would give you an even larger gain, or higher bandwidth.
Got other questions? Okay, good. Thank our speaker again.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, folks are online, what I'm going to do next is, I believe this hangs up everybody on the phone line.
Okay.